Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number Smart Beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number Smart Beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
You are now listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris, where the most influential voices in horror cinema will spill their guts, literally, to the renowned horror director, writer, and producer. Now, here's your host, Mick Garris.
There's no prescribed path to becoming a working director. Some do it from the very beginning. They make short films that get attention, and a production company takes a chance on a first-time director. For me, it was writing that opened the door. Disney was interested in hiring me as a writer when I was working on Amazing Stories and offered me one of their TV movies as my first time out directing. It wasn't great, but then Steven Spielberg offered me an opportunity to tackle one of my own stories for the show, and that turned out well and led to other offers to direct. Tom Holland's route was pretty unique. He was an actor first, then a writer, and that ultimately led to him making his debut as a director with Fright Night. Our paths have crossed surprisingly often, even though we didn't really meet until a few years after our first near intersection. I was working in publicity at Universal when he wrote Psycho 2. I later directed Psycho 4. I was doing publicity on The Beast Within, which he wrote. We finally met when I was story editor on Amazing Stories and he directed an episode. Then I cast him in a cameo in The Stand. Then we both directed episodes of Tales from the Crypt. We've both done multiple Stephen King adaptations. And ultimately, he directed an episode of my Masters of Horror series. Tom's list of genre credits is remarkable, and to have created at least two classics of the horror world is an incredible feat. Tom's story is one of a kind, and I'm eager to dig into it.
This is Postmortem with Mick Garris.
We met with him, Amazing Stories. I did the Jonathan Cryer.
That's right.
And I remember with the day I think I met you, I met Matheson.
Yeah, RC and Father.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's talk about how we met on Amazing Stories. Tell me about your experience working with Spielberg and doing this television show.
Well, what I remember about Steven is he came by when I was shooting and told me how much he loved Fright Night, which I guess is why he remade it. It's too bad he didn't call me before he remade it.
I didn't realize that they had remade it, that it was his company.
Yeah.
Ah, okay. I was doing specialized publicity when Psycho 2 came out. And so I got a copy of the script, and the last three pages were not in it. They weren't allowed to be shown to anybody.
Right.
Tell me about how that came about.
Because that's how Hitchcock did the original.
So he distributed the script to all the cast and crew without the last couple of pages.
Without the last couple of pages, yeah.
And then
because Richard Franklin, who directed Psycho 2, was a mad Hitchcock fan and had, I think at the very beginning, he had Hitchcock down to USC. And I think that was one of the first times. And that the way Richard described it is Hitchcock was shocked that anybody wanted to talk to him in front of a college, you know, film class. And Richard was like the MC, like you are now, with Alfred Hitchcock. I've seen photos of it. And then Hitchcock invited him on the set of Frenzy.
Wow.
And Richard Franklin's now gone, but, you know, if he wasn't the greatest Hitchcock scholar, then Robin Wood, maybe.
Hmm.
But, I mean, Richard knew everything about Hitchcock and about John Ford. And I think that's where I got it, too. He said that they were the two greatest directors in film.
Well, so your start came in a very circuitous way. I mean, you were doing episodic television as an actor in the late 1950s.
I did not the late 1950s. I was under contract to Warner Brothers when I was 18. And that 1963 was the year that JFK was assassinated.
Right, I remember well.
Yeah, I was sitting in a motel in Burbank under contract to Warner's, and they still had the set standing for My Fair Lady. Mm. They still had the outdoor castle set built for Camelot. And Sinatra and the gang were shooting somebody in the Seven Little Hoods.
Oh, right. Robin and the Seven Hoods.
Robin and the Seven Hoods, yes. And, you know, and I sort of just walked around in a state of befuddled fandom.
Were you a big movie fan as a kid?
Huge.
Yeah. And that acting was the first direction you wanted to take? Did you want to be a filmmaker?
No, I couldn't get in. Mm. I couldn't get in. I could go on and on and on.
Go ahead.
Well, it predates you. The business was very, very closed. Also, when I came in, it was on a downturn. They'd had, you know, television had wiped out theater grosses. The Antitrust Act of like 1947, which made them divest of the theaters.
Right. It used to be that the big major studios owned the theaters
as well. Owned distribution, too.
And that was outlawed.
Right. And I think at the same time, Bobby Kennedy was going after MCA Universal for ownership not only of the agencies but also of the studios. And it was an extremely unsettled time. Anyway, what happened was the grosses of the movie started to decline, and they went into television. And for about 7 or 8 years there, the studios did very well, specifically Warner's and I think Universal, but especially Warner's, which is where I was as a contract player.
So you were a contract actor for Warner's.
You could only work
for Warner's.
7 years.
Wow.
I think I started at $250 a week, and I thought I was filthy rich.
Must have felt like it.
It certainly did when you were 18. I had to go down to court to be able to sign the contracts because I was underage.
Wow.
And It was just when it was dying. I guest starred in the last season of 77 Sunset Strip.
You were in combat?
That was later.
Yeah.
But while I was under Warner's, I also did Temple Houston. And I mean, I can't remember everybody that I worked with.
Well, you started at the Actors Studio, Lee Strasberg's, which is the most revered of all acting schools.
I started at Northwestern University.
Ah, okay.
I got into, I did this is to get into college. I did an audition scene for them, for Carnegie Tech, and I got into both, and I went to Northwestern because they had, they at least offered some academics. And, you know, and my mother was screaming in the back of my ear, you know, get an education so you can get a job. I went there, and then I had already started work. I started in the summer of my 16th birthday at Bucks County Playhouse in Pennsylvania, which was a huge summer stock, you know, pre-Broadway tryout theater. And that's where I learned everybody was going to acting classes in New York. So the next summer I clerked in a men's and women's store, and I would ride in once a week, I think on Saturdays, to go to the H.B. Herbert Berghoff Studio, Hagen Berghoff Studios on Bank Street, 21 Bank Street, I still remember.
Wow.
And then I went away to college. But I wanted to direct even then.
Before
I was acting.
Interesting.
But there was no way. When I went to Northwestern, there was no film school. Their film school was in one room. And they had a 16mm camera, and they had some cold splicers.
Mm-hmm.
And in that first year, I did my first film. I shot 16, I don't know, I shot, I don't know, like 2 hours. Milton Casales helped me cut it in New York. The people that I met when I went to New York before I got the 7-year contract, I was in the Walla Group for America, America, for Gadge Kazan.
Wow, yeah.
And then, so I did that, then I did soaps in New York. I was a soap opera star. I did that for about 3 years.
Amazing.
It was amazing. That was a terrific experience.
Now, you had to learn on your feet. That was pretty much close to theater, basically. You went through it pretty much live.
We did do it live.
Right.
There was a time delay for coming out to the West Coast, but if a flat fell down, you kept on with the scene.
It was live, and it was 5 days a week, right?
5 days a week, and I think the most I ever had to memorize was like 41 pages one night.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I could do it then. You know, but you get acclimated to that.
Do you think it taught you a lot of good habits? Did it teach you bad habits to just be able to do something, get it done and get it quick? Or
all of
made
it.
You more nimble?
All of it, Nick. Mm-hmm. All of it. I learned how to... This is the ability I still have, actually. I learned how to put scenes on their feet and make them play and adjust the blocking to making them play. And then I learned off of that how to go to camera angles.
Well, tell me about the actor's studio experience. It's very well known for the method. Was that a philosophy that you subscribed to as an actor?
I don't think I knew. I think that I was just so thrilled that I got in. I think like so much when you're young and even now, it's about fashion. And it was Lee Strasberg was teaching, the most boring man in the world.
Really?
God help me. Yeah.
And yet one of the most revered, probably the most revered instructor of drama.
Stella Adler.
Stella Adler.
Was the best I ever studied with. Yeah. Not Lee, Stella.
Really? So you studied with both?
Yeah.
That's impressive. You have to be invited for these.
Yeah. Yeah. But I don't know how I did it, actually. You know, I got in through, I had help and Herb, the famous actress, and her name is out of my mind, like in the Poseidon Adventure. She got very fat.
Shelley Winters.
Shelley Winters.
Yeah.
Shelley Winters, I think, got me the interview or that I had to get up and do a scene. Then I know when I was out at the actor's studio here, Jack Garfine ran it. And that was Lee at the height of his career, of his fame because of all the actors. And, I mean, everybody was there who was anybody in 1968.
So who were some of your classmates at the actor's studio?
Well, at that point, it was a studio. It wasn't like class.
Right.
You'd go there and you'd see 2, 3, 4 scenes on their feet, which people spent a week rehearsing. And then you'd finish maybe a 15 or 20 minute scene. And Lee would hold forth for 2 hours. And that was where I started to go nuts.
Where you'd get sleepy.
It was Shelley was there. Bruce Dern was there. Bruce Dern's wife was there. The Flying Nun was there.
Sally Field, yeah.
Sally was there. The guy who passed away, Father Knows Best. What's his
Robert
name?
Young.
No, not Robert Young.
James Brolin.
Marsha.
Oh. Okay, now you're into TV land that is beyond my...
Well, no, Marsha's... Yeah,
Brady Bunch. Or,
Brady Bunch, yeah. That was it.
A show I never watched, I'm afraid to say. But.
And what they had was they had a writer's unit.
Ah.
And they also had a writer-playwright unit.
So you studied both acting and playwriting at the studio?
What happened was I started to act in the one-act plays. These were working writers. And people like Jim Bridges.
Right.
Yeah, you know,
wow.
Jim was there. Jim had just finished the sci-fi movie about the computer that took over the world.
Colossus, the Fordham Project.
Colossus,
yeah.
Yes.
Yep.
And there were, it's so hard to grab now, but they were the people that were the hottest writers in Hollywood at that moment, none of whom could write a story, God forbid. But, you know, they were writing, you know, movies that people were doing. This was at the moment in time when Hollywood had truly lost its way.
Mm.
This is just in or around the time or prior to Peter Fonda and...
Right, Easy Rider.
Easy Rider.
Dennis Hopper. This was a real breaking point in the studio system because they discovered that there was a youth audience out there that they knew nothing about. The old ways weren't working anymore.
Right.
They were making, you know, Rex Harrison musicals, and what the audience wanted to see was Easy Rider, which could be made for nothing. And so they would actually take these renegade filmmakers and not pay them much, but still have something that they didn't understand, but could appeal to the young audience.
That sums it up pretty well. Christopher Jones was there. Mm-hmm. Because he went on to do that. He went on to do The Looking Glass War and Ryan's Hope. And, you know, and the first time I saw him, I must have jumped 30 feet because he looked exactly like Jimmy Dean.
Wow.
Yeah. It was all the legends of the 50s into the 60s. Carl Malden, wonderful man, lovely, lovely, lovely man.
And so your move into writing, had you been writing before, or was it stimulated by this experience?
I was trying, but I couldn't. Writing, as you well know, is hard. I mean, you know, the you can take and you can bullshit.
You're fine.
You can bullshit a lot of things, but, you know, you can even bullshit directing, because directing, you have a whole organization underneath you that props you up. Writing, and I guess acting, I could go on and on about this, but acting too is something that where you can see a lot of people that you think are rather mediocre who do extremely well. Some of them become movie stars. So there's never been a direct correlation between talent and success, at least as far as acting is concerned. It's really irrational. And also what happens is that camera reads people in a way that your naked eye doesn't. And there are some people, Clint Eastwood, Charles Bronson, the previous generation, who tack down the frame. You know, I mean, you have people that were absolutely brilliant. Steve McQueen cut every line he had. God forbid if he had to give three or four lines in a row. You know, Kevin Costner was the same way in Robin Hood. That was, you know, the projection was weak on that. But in reaction shots, they're brilliant. In other words, there are a lot of different ways to look at film acting. So looking at somebody doing a scene on a stage did not necessarily tell me how terrific or not that they would be on film. Anyway, I met a lot of writers. And that was the moment in time when the writers were trying to knock down the door and get into Hollywood and make films. And it occurred to me that if I wanted to direct, that writing might be the way to do it. Now, while I was doing that, I was working production and commercials. You know, I mean, I was just doing everything. And I directed commercials. I started directing Hasbro and the stupid dolls, whatever they were. I did a whole bunch of really cheap children's commercials. But all that led me to was better paying jobs in terms of directing commercials.
Right, which is not where you wanted to be.
No, so it seemed like getting there was just impossible. But the way I saw it going at that time was original screenplays. Hard as that is to imagine now, but they were totally open to original screenplays because of what you saw, what you said, the youth revolution, the baby boomers. Yeah. As we age out now, then we're the millennials of their day. And so it was how to feed that audience. And there was huge confusion in Hollywood. They didn't yet bring it down to a science of how to reduce risk, which of course is what's been going on the last 10, 15 years, 20 years.
Well, your first produced screenplay, if I'm not mistaken, was that the Initiation of Sarah?
Yeah.
And that was kind of controversial because it was made and they said they were making a European version and got a lot of the actresses, from what I recall, to actually do nude scenes that were never going to be used in this ABC TV movie, but were going to be used in air quotes in Europe.
Okay, now what I remember is it was the first wet T-shirt movie of the week that they did. They took that blonde lady, they took her and they threw her in a fountain at UCLA. And she came walking out with a T-shirt and it was soaking wet. And then, of course, her nipples got harder. And you saw all that. And that was absolutely scandalous.
Yeah.
It was the lead article in the LA Times magazine, which the binder they used to have, which was all the theater stuff, and it was the front cover, and it was quite a cause celeb.
So how did that come about? Was this the first screenplay you'd completed, or just the first one that had been produced? Was it the first one you sold?
Well, I started out writing TV thanks to a man called Dick Berg. But Dick Berg was a terrific producer, and Dick had cast me as an actor in a Chrysler theater called Bus Riley's Back in Town, which starred Michael, and he just passed away. Tarantino picked him up all the time.
Michael Parks. Yeah.
Starred Michael Parks, who then was the hottest thing in Hollywood. And Anne Bancroft. And Jack Warden. So Dick remembered me from working with him as an actor. And I had, of course, by that time I had sample scripts and he gave me a shot. And that turned into Initiation of Sarah, except, of course, I was rewritten. And I was rewritten, and this was a habit I had for years, I was writing ahead of what special effects could do. And a lot of what I wrote was the sorority girls were fighting with each other, and there was a witch in there someplace, and the evil witch or the good witch, however you want to look at it, was turning the mean girls into barnyard animals. And ABC read that script and went like, well, we can't, they just physically couldn't do it.
Right.
You know, so they made it much more possible. I don't know about the nudity. That I didn't know about.
That's what I remember, and maybe it...
They certainly skirted scandalous as much as they could in terms right. of, you know, in terms of the girls involved.
How close did the movie turn out to be compared to what you had written?
Structurally, very close. I mean, you know, there was that period when I was working through the mid-late 90s when really the only thing I had to fear was a dialogue polish. You know, I mean, I think that this
So you didn't really have too much interference from studio execs or a director or producer saying, here, we're bringing somebody in to bring their take into it.
No, what I did was, and I don't know how I had this tact, but I did, is that I worked assiduously to make an ally out of the director. And the other thing that I did was I started boarding the scenes as I wrote them. So I would sit there with the director and storyboard. And so what I was doing was I was locking the director into what I'd written. And that was one way of being self-protective. And the other was that I started to structure the scripts with go on and on about this for hours, with a rising suspense line. And you really could not screw with it much. If you pulled a brick out, the whole edifice teetered, and if you pulled another one out, it came crashing down.
Right.
Not that that always helped. But, you know, I mean, you know, I have film Scream for Help, which I think they just played down at the New Beverly as an example of one of the worst films of 1980, I think. And I understand the great hilarity. But, I mean, that was a terrific script. It was The Stepfather about 6 months before The Stepfather. And it was unreleasable. And Michael Winner directed it. And Michael Winner was as nice and as charming and as wonderful as you could get. He didn't have a clue about suspense.
No, he became a very successful reviewer of restaurants.
Yes, yes. Yeah. But I mean, if you look at his credits, he had an unbroken line of directing movies for 25 years.
Yeah.
Never stopped. Yeah.
Were you a particular fan of the horror genre? You've had your greatest success starting with Psycho 2 and Beast Within as a writer and then as a director with Fright Night and Child's Play and all the things that have come since. Were you always a fan of the genre or was it expedient?
No, I was. Yeah. But I wasn't like, I'm only going to do this.
Right.
I mean, I was always a fan of horror and suspense. I think a lot of it was psychological suspense, too. I very much loved Hitchcock, you know. I mean, I really thought Psycho was the greatest movie I ever saw, you know, when I was a kid. It blew me away. But I didn't have an objection to it, but at that moment in time and the way that I came up through the 70s, I knew the older people I knew, a great cinematographer and director called Guy Green. He cast me in Walk in the Spring Rain with Ingrid Bergman and Tony Quinn. And I got to try to rape Ingrid Bergman. And I got to French kiss her.
Oh.
But I saw, with that, I saw the old Hollywood. And through that association with those people, I saw the Academy as it was in 1980. And that was, I just took on their standards of what was good. And they looked down on horror. They looked down on it as a, you know, as that it wasn't a serious film.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, so I had a lot of older peer group pressure who were saying, you know, don't do horror. You can't get trapped and you have to get out of it, even though that's really...
That was making the money.
Yes. And, yeah. And what I, and also what I enjoyed. But that was the... So I ended up making Fatal Beauty with Whoopi Goldberg.
Right.
And now Whoopi has just been elected to the Board of Governors of the Academy.
There you go.
So go figure. But anyway, yeah.
Yeah, I remember doing publicity at Universal, and it must have been 1981. And this was when Psycho 2 was coming out, somewhere around
82.
82, yeah. And I used to see Hitchcock being driven to his office still every day, being helped, very frail. His chauffeur would take him into his office very slowly, very gently. And it was something that just stuck in my head the whole time.
Well, me too.
Yeah.
Because I was there looking for work in that lot when Hitchcock still had his bungalow.
Right.
There were a bunch of bungalows.
Which became John Landis's after he left, after he passed away. Yeah.
That was the moment in time. His wife had had a stroke, and she was at home, bedridden. Yeah. I don't know how cognizant she was. And Hitchcock would come in, and then he'd have a lunch, which was like our dinner, had his cook in his private, cook and chauffeur. He never drove.
Right.
And then he would get blind drunk. Hmm. You know, that's the truth. And they would drive him home, and that would be his day. But the one that I heard, that was on Psycho 2, that was the last gasp of the group, the production group that had surrounded Hitchcock. Hilton Green produced that. He was Hitch's first on the original Psycho.
Yeah. He was my producer on Psycho 4. Yeah.
Well, he was a terrific guy.
Wonderful man.
Wonderful. I'm so sorry. And I just read they lost Doc Erickson, too.
Hmm.
And Doc produced Cloak and Dagger.
Right.
You know? I mean, terrific. I mean, these just the people. Maybe the people that were the adults when I was doing all this, I thought were just, generally speaking, wonderful. And the people in production.
So the studio system worked for you.
Well, it worked great.
Yeah.
I mean, they don't remember now, but you know that the studios were like families. And the entire studio would vote in a block for whatever that studio's movies were for the Academy Awards.
Mm.
But there was a great sense of family in Hollywood. You catch a little bit of that flavor the way Westwood used to be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I can't remember all the names, but boy, I met a lot of them. They were just terrific people. And everybody, Hitchcock was God, you know, but I mean, it was just amazing the time anyway, you know, so I heard all the stories about Mr. Hitchcock.
Yes, it was always Mr. Hitchcock or Hitch. The actors called him Hitch. Everyone else who wore a tie called him Mr. Hitchcock.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Let's talk about your move into directing. I mean, you started out bang with an iconic film.
Which one?
Fright Night, right?
Oh, yeah.
But as a director, your feature directing debut was Fright Night. How did that come about? Tell me.
Well,
Did you write a script that they wanted badly and they
Well, I got so upset at Scream for Help. Mm-hmm. But I said, well, if anybody's going to screw up my movies from now on, it's going to be me. You know, why should I let somebody else do that? And therefore, I insisted on directing Fright Night. And I remember MGM tried to buy it from me. And I don't remember how much now, but it was multiples of $100,000. And I wouldn't let it go. And there were people who thought I was insane.
Mm-hmm.
But I was so hot as a screenwriter at that moment. And once again, I got support from a studio exec named John Byers. Robert Lawrence was another one. Mm-hmm. And Guy McElwain, who was then head of Columbia, backed me. But the reason that Guy McElwain backed me was because we had met socially previously. And I've always found myself tongue-tied. Mm-hmm. You know, I never was very good socially or at selling myself. And I would meet Guy. He was dating Portland Mason, who was James Mason's daughter.
Daughter, right.
And he would come over to that house, which was Buster Keaton's old mansion, which was owned by Pamela Mason, the mother.
Right.
Ex-wife of James.
And talk show host. Yes.
And talk show host. And everybody who was anybody in Hollywood of that generation, the previous generation to us, was there. That was where I'd walk in and I would see Gregory Peck.
Hmm.
I'd walk in and I would see not Johnny Carson, but the sidekick, Ed McMahon.
Oh, Ed McMahon. Sure.
And also the guy who produced Johnny Carson. And it was, I mean, I remember when Nixon was going down, the John whoever who did Nixon in was there. The British critic who was such an enfant terrible that everybody talked about who wrote so brilliantly was there when he was dying of emphysema. These are names that you'd remember, but I can't remember them now either. But I mean, it was the glitterati of the people that had started in the 40s, had their big careers 50s and 60s, and now were. So and there's where I met Guy. And so Guy didn't even know my name. But when I went in to meet him after the script was recommended, he said, "Oh, it's you."
Uh-huh.
Because he'd seen me there.
So you were able to straddle the golden age of Hollywood in a way and move into the modern Hollywood. With Fright Night as a director, there's this incredible fondness for the genre and for, well, Roddy McDowell's Peter Vincent is such an amalgam of the horror hosts that every city had on their TV station. Tell me how that came about and this affection that obviously you shared with the audience for that era and for these monsters and for these hosts.
Well, I came up watching the Hammer / AIP movies, which were, you know, heavily saturated. All the Christopher Lee stuff, you know, was, you know, we get back, wide proscenium arch, so you could see the set.
Mm-hmm.
And was very by the numbers kind of cutting. But I had a great fondness for those movies and Vincent Price. And that was my childhood. And when I was a kid, the only place you could find a horror movie on TV was what they called the Friday Night Frights.
Right.
Which was like an independent channel at 11 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd put something on, which was god-awful. But who cared and who knew? And so that was the time that I grew up. And that's what I remembered. And that's me that I put into Fright Night. The fan, the gonzo fan. But they had the host. They had the horror host,
right,
you know,
Stagger right.
Lee. And,
sure.
Yeah,
there was Zachary and there was, you know, Elvira.
Of course, always Elvira. Yeah.
But every city had one. Svengoolie, all these different horror
mm-hmm.
hosts. Did you actually make a study of those, or you basically just based it on your childhood?
I'd lived
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
I'd grown up with it. I mean, that was me. And if what happened to Charlie Brewster,
mm-hmm.
I would have loved that to happen to me. It was the wish fulfillment of all time, you know, with when I, you know, I wrote that script and I'd finish a scene and I'd lay on the floor and I'd kick my feet in laughter.
Well, tell me, who were your favorite monsters? Was it the Universal classics?
I think.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think if there were any others. There were all kinds of stuff that were coming up in the exploitation stuff.
Right.
You know?
Well, the 50s and 60s certainly had a profound abundance of monsters.
Yeah.
The Japanese monsters, the kaiju, any of those, or was it really more homegrown?
No, more homegrown.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Godzilla's terrific, but, you know, but God, those movies were terrible.
Okay, so Hammer versus Universal.
Well, what Hammer did was take the vampire stories, and they echoed, you know, the original novel. And that created its own genre. Then they moved into psychological tales with Singer, mm-hmm. with the writer who came in and did like, tried to, when it all started to change after Psycho.
Right.
The writer director came in who was terrific. And he did about 7 or 8 psychological stories for Hammer too. Sangster.
Jimmy Sangster.
Sangster. The,
well, there was a change also in the 70s in particular where they became much more permissive and much more adult in nature. In the U.S., horror movies were for kids. The Hammer movies started to bring in sex and explicit violence.
They certainly did.
And how did you feel about that? I mean, the Universal classics were very chaste.
Yes.
But they were also probably, most of us, our first experiences with
Barbara Steele and, you know, and Heaving Bosoms.
Yes, I bit in the pendulum.
You know, at 13 or 14, I thought that was terrific. But that was, you know, and that passed out of style, too. That passed out of style with Psycho. That's how Hitchcock, Hitchcock birthed modern horror.
Well, modern horror became contemporary, and it became about something that's real. It didn't take place in castles in Europe, in the fog and the mists and bats and things.
Right.
But it was the guy next door, or the guy running the motel down the street, you know?
Yeah.
How did that affect you as a writer? Fright Night is very much a picture of its time, very contemporary and very modern for when it was made. And was that a specific attempt, or it was just a reflection of when you wrote and directed it?
Well, I think that was a specific attempt. I mean, I was writing Cloak and Dagger,
right,
which was ostensibly a remake of The Window.
But it was
an original.
Yeah, it really doesn't resemble The Window very much. 1947, it's like a 60-minute movie. It's a great little film. But you turned it into something very different.
For those of the audience out there, The Window is the juvenile version of Rear Window, but the same writer, Cornell Woolrich.
Right.
Who was a great psychological writer. The guy, I don't know how much he wrote, but he has something like 48 films made off of his material.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
A wonderful noir writer from the 30s and 40s and 50s.
Psychological noir.
Really great stuff.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, when I was writing that, it wasn't strong enough to be able to make a movie out of. So I invented the imaginary character, Jack Black. But when I was doing that, I said, if you really want to do a movie where a kid looks out his window and sees something next door, it should be a vampire next door. At which everybody said, that's the most ridiculous, stupid idea I've ever heard. You know? So, but it wouldn't let me go. And when I finished Cloak and Dagger, I don't know what I was doing, but the story kept eating at me. And so I wrote, I spec'd Fright Night. And that was probably one of the most enjoyable writing experiences I've ever had.
It's great to write on spec where nobody's giving you notes or anything.
Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah. Well, let's get to Chucky Land.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me what state that was in when you got it. There was an existing screenplay, and you, once you took on the job, had a lot to do with where that screenplay went.
Well, it was a screenplay by Don Mancini,
right,
called Blood Buddy.
Uh-huh.
Ah, and it was like, you know, I love, you know, thank God that he did it, because who would have thought of it otherwise? However, it was more like an episode of Twilight Zone, and it didn't work. But the way I came up, the way you came up, you would rewrite a script, but you would still keep as much as you could.
Right.
And so I spent like a year trying to rewrite that, and I couldn't do it. Because I really had to break with it. What happened was, the little boy went to sleep, and the doll woke up, because he made the doll a blood buddy, ergo the title. And the little boy, the doll would go out and kill the people the little boy didn't like, his dentist, his teacher. But there was nobody to root for or care for, and there was no villain. But I couldn't do it. So I left it. And then another director came in, and he brought in the other writer who's on the list, who got credit. But they didn't break it. Mm-hmm. They were still stuck with the same story. And then that director, I think it may have been Joe Rubin, who directed
Stepfather. Yeah,
I
think
it was
Joe Rubin. Yeah.
But he walked away from it.
Mm.
And I was sitting in a coffee shop with Dean Reisner.
Mm-hmm.
Remember Dean Reisner's name?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Dean Reisner was a terrific rewrite man around Hollywood. Everybody used him. There isn't anything that he didn't write on. Make My Day. He did the polish on everything. But I was sitting talking to him, and I don't know, they come back to me with Child's Play. And I was sitting there, and all of a sudden I knew how to write it. I saw Charles Lee Ray in my head. Mm-hmm. I needed a villain, and I needed some way to exculpate the boy. And if I had a serial murderer who somehow could put his soul inside a doll, then I had a really badass doll. Mm-hmm. And then I had a little boy and a mother trying to protect the little boy, so the audience had somebody to work with. And I don't know, I'd spent like a year, maybe longer, the first time around, trying to structure a story that would work, and I couldn't do it. And then all of a sudden I did. And I don't know why, how those things happen. It's the same way, you have an idea, you sit around, you carry it around for 6 months, year, 10 years, and then all of a sudden one morning you wake up and you say, Eureka! Mm-hmm. And you know how to solve it, but it was when I came up with Charles Lee Ray. That's what made the doll was originally called Buddy. What got me in the first place was they come out with the first chips in dolls,
right?
Computer chips. They come out with My Buddy doll,
right?
Which was another reason I couldn't use the name because it conflicted. And so
they would talk and they would move in.
But the difference was you didn't know what they were going to say.
Right.
When we were little kids growing up, you'd be laying down, they'd say, I want to go to sleep, I want to pee, whatever. Right. Only one line or two lines.
Chatty Cathy and Betsy Wetsy.
Yeah, but you never knew, once they came out with My Buddy, you never knew what the damn thing was going to say.
Mm-hmm.
And that meant that you might even think it was alive.
Mm-hmm.
And you also had something else. I very much like dealing with phobias which are universal, which are so in mankind that everybody understands them. And I think all of us, when we were growing up, have thought with a mixture of fear and delight what it would be like if our playthings came alive. And that was one of the great underlying phobia in Child's Play. And also, there was something else driving me. I had seen Richard Matheson's Trilogy of Terror.
Oh, yeah, with the Zuni doll. Yeah.
Dan Curtis directing with Kieran mm-hmm. Black, yeah.
Right, and that, three stories TV movie. Yeah.
Right, amazing that they could get that on. That was like 1968. You couldn't get anything like that on TV since.
Yeah, it was
because that
great.
Was truly terrifying.
Yeah.
But what he did was he took a 16mm camera and he put it on roller skates. They didn't even have skateboards at the time, I don't think, but he put it on roller skates. And he chased Kieran Black around that apartment with the doll's point of view. And it was, I thought it was just dynamite.
Dolly cam, yeah.
Dolly cam. Dolly cam 2 inches above the floor.
Nice.
This is before, you know, you try to put these things in historical perspective. This was before Steadicams.
Mm-hmm.
Steadicam sort of equates to me with The Shining.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, there was no way to move the camera. I mean, you were dealing with big 35s. When I started, they still had Mitchells.
Right.
You know what I mean? Cameras.
The Gone with the Wind cameras.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, so I knew that if I got in trouble with the doll, that I could always cut to a moving point of view if I structured scenes where the doll was chasing people.
Well, let's talk about that doll. Kevin Yeager designed this with. Mm-hmm. Tell me how that came to be, what your input was, what you were looking for from that good guy doll.
I took my buddy, and I took Raggedy Ann and Raggedy Andy.
Okay.
And I said the color should be like Raggedy Andy. And I need to go from, you know, benign facial expression to something that'll scare the hell out of you. But it has to start innocent. It has to start where the doll looks so much like a doll when the little boy starts saying, when Andy starts saying, well, the doll's talking to me.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's going to believe you because they look at this, you know, this sweet doll. But I needed it to go from there into something out of hell.
Now tell me about the challenges of working with you. Sometimes it was a puppet, sometimes it was someone inside a good guy suit. Was that particularly challenging, or it was just part of production?
It was extremely challenging.
It's a leading question.
Yeah, I mean, really. Well, we fell behind. I mean, I couldn't get the doll's eyes to stay in place for reverse shots.
Mm.
The doll's eyes would start to just wonder. And if you're trying to cut somebody talking to the doll talking back, and the eyes have to be on who's talking. The doll couldn't move. I had seen something else. I had also seen Darby O'Gill and the Little People.
Oh, yeah. Which Disney movie.
Well, I think that was also James Bond's first movie.
Sean Connery. Yeah.
And they used forced perspective.
Forced perspective to make the little leprechauns.
That's right.
Yep.
So I used forced perspective. And then I also went and I got a little person who was just terrific. And he's going to shoot me. He might. Name's out of my head right now. I used a real doll. I used Steadicam moving point of view. I used forced perspective. And I also used a little person in Chucky garb, which means that I had to build all the sets big.
Mm-hmm.
Because so like...
As a little person, still not as little as a good guy.
That's for sure. That's for sure. And we had like the fireplace, you know, when he busts out of the fireplace. That's Ed Gale. Ed Gale was the person. That's Ed Gale doing it. But I built the fireplace up big enough that it made Ed Gale look like he was still Chucky's size.
Right.
And I also did that in the kitchen in the voodoo priest's house when Chucky's on the rampage in there. And so it was put together with bits, snippets of film.
Right.
From, you know, using all of it together. And I did a commentary, I guess, on a recent release. I think it was through Shout Factory.
Shout Factory, yeah, and the Blu-ray.
And I went and I tried to call, as it was playing on the screen, I tried to call what was it? Was it Kevin Yeager's Chucky? Was it Ed Gale in a Chucky suit? Was it a forced perspective? You know, and I couldn't do it all the time.
That's good.
Yeah.
I
got confused about what I'd use when.
And Kevin Yeager was married to Catherine Hicks.
They weren't at the time, but they were lovers, and certainly it was a blooming romance.
Yes.
And the unsung heroine of Child's Play is Catherine Hicks. She did a brilliant performance. She really, really did. And what happened, I trimmed it. I cut it down because it slowed down. The humanity slowed down the pell-mell rush of the... Of the roller coaster ride.
And it's a genre film, and you wanted to deliver to that audience.
Well, I didn't.
Oh, it
but
was but cut
certainly,
down, not
but
by
certainly
you.
Others did.
Okay.
So I trimmed back what I thought was really an award-winning performance from her, and promoted, of course, Chucky.
Right.
You know?
Did you have a visual style in mind? Were there any movies that inspired how you were going to shoot this?
No, there was no prototype for Chucky and Child's Play. But I had a brilliant production designer. I had John and John Jr. DeCure.
Oh, DeCure, yeah. Jr. did Sleepwalkers for me.
Okay,
and
well,
Kevin Yeager did Fuzzbucket for the first thing I ever directed.
Okay.
Greater than so. Okay. Again, we keep passing.
Well, John and John's father.
Well, John's father, who did Cleopatra.
Everything.
Yeah, I mean, giant stuff.
Well,
quite a team.
Yeah, well, that also is a secret of the success of Fright Night, was that basically Columbia... Shel Schrager essentially turned over the whole production crew of Ghostbusters to me. So that's how I got Richard Edlund.
Uh-huh.
And Richard Edlund brought in all those brilliant artists, you know, on that one. And Kevin was just terrific on Child's Play. But we were also learning as we went, because nobody had ever done it. And this is a couple of beats before CGI.
Right.
You know, so there you either did it in camera or you didn't do it.
Right.
And it was hellaciously difficult to pull it off, but it just required time, you know.
Let's talk a little bit about your Stephen King collaborations. First of all, you played a small part in The Stand.
Yes, I did. Thank you very much for casting me.
Which, you blew up real good.
Thank you.
So then along came Langoliers and Thinner. Tell me how those came about.
Oh, boy. True story. I don't know if you know this. They offered me The Stand.
Oh, I did not know
that. Yes. And they offered me The Stand when it was still a feature film.
Ah, after George Romero had been on it for 15 years trying to get it going. Yeah.
God. Well, they had a script that must have been about 217 pages.
Well, what I shot was 465.
Well, I mean, I said, you can't do this as a movie.
Yeah.
And I said, do it as a miniseries. But nobody at that moment in time wanted to do it as a miniseries. Yeah. but I was a big fan of the novella of Langoliers.
Mm-hmm.
Langoliers really, I think it's terrific. And I think it's terrific because of the actors involved in it. But the production was ramshackle.
Mm-hmm.
And
we won't mention the production company.
No, of course
here.
Not. We're tactful at this point in our lives.
Right.
I had read it in a short story collection, I think, and it was the novella that led it off, I think. And I thought it was just the driving sense of narrative that Stephen got in that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it was, and I knew he was riffing off the Twilight Zone, which I'd seen. Anyway, I thought that was a terrific piece of material. And it was like the biggest miniseries that ABC had that year or something. But it seems to have gotten lost. And I think that's because the CGI is so...
It was in its formative years.
In its formative stages,
yes.
CGI was.
Yeah.
It wasn't the fault of the guys
right.
that were doing it. Tom, somebody, and very, very nice, talented guys. But They didn't leave it. The producers didn't leave enough time to render it, on and on and on.
No, I'm familiar with that, too.
So I ended up doing that. And then off of that, because of the success of that, I got thinner. And, you know, and I thought...
You mean the movie.
The movie, yeah. I got thinner and I got thinner the movie.
Okay.
And thinner the movie is sort of, you know, I like the movie. I think it's very good. Once again, the acting, I think it's terrific. Robert John Burke. And everybody in it. But that was very unusual in terms, you know, we're talking about all the things that went well. Let's talk a little bit about the ups and downs. We previewed Thinner, and the audience would stay rooted to the spot up until the last 5 minutes, and then they turned on the film and hated it. And I think it was because the titular hero, Billy, lost in the end.
Mm-hmm.
And the theme of the movie was moral jellyfish gets squished in the end. But I think that I didn't write it right. I think that I made Billy into too much of a protagonist, and I should have shown the hypocrite side, so you'd understand why he got the bitter bit at the end. Why he lost.
Perhaps it was something that worked better as a book for an ending than...
The audience hated him losing at the end.
Yeah,
I've never had a movie where the audience was absolutely thrilled with it into the last few minutes. They did not want to see Billy lose. And that meant that I didn't show the darker side of his character. The hypocrite, the someone who used power in the town to get out of, you know, out of his punishment. You know, and all of those things. So that's always left me with a feeling that you have to be extremely careful about endings, and it's better to go with a happy ending than with a down ending, you know? So anyway.
Yeah, look at The Mist.
that's
as grim as it gets, yeah.
That's as grim as it gets. Yep. It made $1.95, but now we're getting a TV series. And I love Frank, so that isn't...
Of course. I think The Mist is a great film.
Okay, well, you see, I thought it was a horrifying ending.
Yeah, it is. It's as dark as it gets. Yeah.
But that is...
And that's not what an audience wants to see.
Well, it's a deliberate choice in the case of The Mist, and I think that he had some of the same problems, which was he didn't show the bad side of the characters involved. It was James, I think, was the lead. But you liked him too much, and you didn't want him and his kid to have that as an ending because he didn't deserve it.
Yeah, it's interesting. King, when he saw it, said, if I'd thought of that ending, that's how I'd have ended
But maybe you would have written it so you've been more ambivalent about the characters. Anyway, I felt that Billy Halleck in Thinner, I thought I made him too much of a good guy, and I should have shown why he deserved to get screwed in the end, because the audience sure as hell did not like to see him lose at the end.
Let's talk about Rock, Paper, Dead.
Ah, yes, okay.
Tell me what it is. Tell me...
Well, it's out there, and, you know, I guess being set up in the festival circuit, I don't know. It was a very good script written by Victor Miller and a co-writer, Carrie Fleming. And it echoed Psycho 2.
Ah.
It's, you know, and I didn't tell them that, but, you know, I thought, well, maybe this is a chance to do Norman for the, you know, for the 21st century. And it had some, terrific actors. It had a woman, a girl called Jennifer Titus. It had Michael Madsen, and it had Tatum O'Neill.
Wow.
Yeah. So, and Victor Miller had written the original, Friday the 13th.
Uh-huh.
So I had a good piece of material, and I had a good cast.
Is it a horror film or a thriller?
Well, I thought it was a psychological thriller with horror tropes,
uh-huh.
Which is to say that the horror came in with the violence of the murders. But otherwise, what made it interesting was the psychological tit and tat, because it's a Psycho 2 story. You know, he gets released, and the relative of one of his victims comes back to drive him insane and to get her vengeance.
And something we can look forward to soon.
Well, it was interesting, you know. And I have hopes for it, but it's not a roller coaster ride. It's mm-hmm. not Child's Play. But then Fright Night isn't Child's Play either.
Well, we've got some questions from our audience that we're going to get to that came through Twitter. You can send us questions at PostmortemMG. Mike asks, at one point you were attached to direct Stephen King's The 10 O'Clock People. What happened with that project?
I have been trying for probably 4 years to get that made, and I do not know why, but I cannot.
Scott asks, what is your favorite writing job you did not direct?
Psycho 2.
Gotta be Psycho 2, right?
Yeah, but I mean, I gotta tell you that the script for Beast Within was just terrific. The script for The Honor.
Huh? I remember it.
The script for the one that was unreleasable, Scream for Help, was sensational. I don't think, except for Psycho 2, I don't know if I thought it really thought a director ever really fulfilled what was on the page. Franklin did with Psycho 2, but the rest of them, no.
The page was
better than what was on film.
That's why so many writers become directors.
Yeah.
Self-preservation. Okay. Adrian asks, can we end by saying, this is the end, friend?
That's terrific. That's terrific. Yes. This is the end, friend.
Thanks for being with us, Tom.
Thank you very much, Mick. Thank you, too.
Thanks for listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris. Download new episodes every other Wednesday and subscribe on iTunes.